Here's a little outline of Ezekiel, and the structure of Ezekiel is very, very important. You know, it's climaxed with a vision of a new city and a new temple. It's the climax, you remember? The last eight chapters, we're having a new city and a new Jerusalem, and you remember that the river of God now is flowing out of the temple. You remember it's a river that gets deeper and deeper and deeper, and there are trees with healing for the nations, etc. It's a wonderful climax. But the structure there of the book, you'll see the first 24 chapters are this period when Ezekiel is over in Babylon, okay, but Jerusalem has not yet been destroyed. Okay, Judah is a province now of Babylon, but they have not destroyed Jerusalem. And this is the first 24 chapters. He's over in Babylon, and that takes us up to the siege of Jerusalem, because you remember what happened is that the Jews that were left here rebelled against the rule of Babylon, which Jeremiah told them not to do, but they did. You remember, and they killed the governor, Gedaliah, etc. And so then the Babylonians simply came in and wiped out everything. And so the first half takes us up to the siege, okay? Then this section from 33 to 48 begins with the end of the siege and with a completely different vision, because now judgment is over. Chapters 1 to 24, that was the threat of judgment. Okay, the siege begins. And then 33 to 48, judgment is over. And so now we can have promise. We can have New Jerusalem. We can have the reconstruction of the temple, etc. And in between 25 to 32 are a section of prophecies against the nations. They're just slotted in there, and you'll see why as we move along. Okay, so that's a basic structure, very simple. And now we're going to look at these prophecies that will take us up. Okay, so Ezekiel is in Babylon, but he's trying to warn Jerusalem and Judea, okay, so that there wouldn't be this devastating destruction by the Babylonians. Okay, so this is this 12-13 year period where he's prophesying in Babylon. They're being carried back to Jerusalem, and there's some very interesting and intriguing things in there. So turn to chapter 4. That's where we'll begin, Ezekiel and chapter 4. Okay, Ezekiel 4, through this section where he's trying to warn them, okay, so that there will not be the destruction of the temple and the city. Writing from Babylon, okay, he's among the exiles, the first wave of exiles, and these are his messages, okay, to Judah and Jerusalem, and that's what we're looking at. And we'll begin in chapter 4. And we've got now three prophetic acts, okay? Ezekiel is the prophet who loves to dramatize his words by doing things, prophetic actions. And we'll see some of them. If you saw somebody do what Ezekiel did, you would never, ever, ever forget it. Okay, as you'll see in just a moment. Never, ever forget it. I had a friend, and he's a wonderful friend, and he was preaching in a very middle class, well, almost upper class, wealthy church. And he's a great, great preacher, good friend of mine, Graham Warner. And suddenly he wanted to illustrate something, and there was a bunch of daffodils, you know, on the side of the pulpits. And so he picked up a daffodil and he ate it, you know, right there in front of the congregation. He ate the daffodil. Now, I don't know what he was explaining, but it was something, you know, come to him just spontaneously. And now if you saw Graham eat the daffodil, you'd never forget that, okay? You'd never forget that. And if you saw Ezekiel do something, yeah, and that was the point, you see. That was the point. that, as I said last week, Ezekiel, for these 12 years, is largely dumb. Literally, he is dumb, except when he gets a prophetic word. And he's dumb because Israel is deaf. But perhaps Israel can still see. So he acts it out. I should mention that after the sermon, Graham went, as one does, you know, you leave the platform, and he was violently sick after, but he managed to get through the sermon. But afterwards, that daffodil came back up, and so just in case you're tempted to eat daffodils. Are they?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's why. He didn't know that. So, but otherwise he was okay. So there's a warning for you, you see. Don't eat daffodils. I never knew that. So, okay, chapter 4, verse 1. And it says, "Now you, son of man, get yourself a brick, place it before you, and inscribe a city on it, Jerusalem." Okay, so it's to build a model. "Then lay siege against it, build a wall, raise up a ramp, pitch camps, and place battering rams against it all around. Then get yourself an iron plate and set it up as an iron wall between you and the city." So Ezekiel will represent initially the Lord, okay, but he's now got like an iron tray up against his face, and it's as if the heavens are brass, and God has had to harden his heart and his face against his people. And then verse 4, "And as for you, lie down on your left side, and lay the iniquity of the house of Israel on it." That's on yourself, on your left side. "And you shall bear the iniquity for the number of days that you lie on your left side. For I have assigned you a number of days corresponding to the years of their iniquity, 390 days. Thus you shall bear the iniquity of the house of Israel, the northern kingdom." And so he was to lay on the ground, bound, okay, for over a year. For over a year. Bound, laying on the ground for over a year. Now you can imagine, everybody's going to hear about that. You know, this is a man of stature. This is a man who's a priest. This is a man who's a prophet. Everybody's going to hear about what this man is doing. Okay, and then verse 6, "And when you've completed these 390 days, you shall lie down a second time, but on your right side, and bear the iniquity of the house of Judah. I have assigned it to you 40 days, a year for each day." And notice in verse 8, "Now behold, I will put ropes on you so that you cannot turn from one side to the other." So it's almost like a sacrificial animal bound. Of course, you only lay down either when you're sleeping or, you know, when you're dead, you know. So it's almost like a scapegoat, like a sacrificial lamb bound in front of the great iniquity of Israel. So what we've got happening here is to lay for over a year on one side and 40 days on the other side, and the 390 days representing the 390 years probably go back to the separation of Israel from Judah in 931. You remember, and the northern kingdom went into idolatry at that time. And the 40 days representing the 40 years for Judah when he lies on the other side are probably the last 40 years when Judah plunged more and more into idolatry itself. And then it's very interesting because he acts as a sacrificial animal almost, because this is all priestly language. He's to bear their iniquity. It's all taken from Leviticus or Numbers. He's to bear their iniquity, and of course he's dumb at this time, and many make a connection between him and the suffering servant of Isaiah 53, and it says there, "As a sheep is silent before his shearers, so he doesn't open his mouth. And so he's like a slain animal bound on the altar. Metaphorically, you see, this sin has got to be atoned for. It's got to be atoned for. And so he's almost like a messianic figure, like the suffering servant. He can't speak. He's dumb, okay, and he is in this position. Now, probably, he sets up the model, and I wouldn't think, you know, that he was permanently laying on the ground. In other words, he probably did it for a period each day. Perhaps it was at that period when most people would be out and about. You know, then obviously, you know, I believe he would get up, you know, and go, you know, and do his normal domestic, you know, duties, etc., etc. So I wouldn't think of him laying on the ground for over a year without moving. I don't think that that's realistic. But they would get the message, you know, that he was now acting as a vicarious sacrifice for the sins of the people. And so, you know, if you imagine it, it's tremendously graphic, you know, that for over a year, you know, he's going to be lying there in front of this model of the city, you know, trussed up, you know, unable to move, you know, like a lamb bound, you know, on the horns of the altar. I mean, you'd never, ever forget that. Never, ever forget that. And this is the message of, you see, the prophetic word, you know, has got to be taken seriously. You know, we've got to remember it. You know, we've got to honor it. And it was very powerful language. Then he does a second one in chapter 4 and verse 10, and a second prophetic act. And the food which you eat shall be 20 shekels a day by weight. So that's 8 ounces of food. And you shall eat it from time to time. And the water you drink will be a sixth part of a hin. That's just over a pint by measure, which isn't very much if you're in the heat of the Middle East. And you shall drink it from time to time. And you shall eat it as a barley cake. Okay, that's the 8 ounces of grain, having baked it in their sight over human dung. In other words, just like they would sometimes use cow dung, not in Israel, in India they still do, you remember, use cow dung as a fuel. You're to use, you know, human excrement. And in other words, he's saying things are going to get so bad, and this is either speaking of the siege or actually when they're on their way to exile, that they won't even be able to maintain ritual purity anymore. They'll be on starvation rations. They can't maintain their separation, the purity laws, the food laws anymore. And for a Jew, that would just be horrible, just horrible. And then the third prophetic act, chapter 5, is even more dramatic. And what I would really like this morning is somebody with long hair and a long beard. Mm. Now just imagine that somebody in the class, okay, had long hair and a long beard, okay? Chapter 5 and verse 1, third prophetic act. And as for you, son of man, take a sharp sword, take and use it as a barber's razor on your head and on your beard. Then take scales for weighing and divide the hair. And one third you'll burn in the fire at the center of the city when the days of the siege are completed. I believe that's the acting out of the siege, which he had done. Then you should take one third and strike it with the sword all around the city. And one third you shall scatter to the wind, okay, and unsheathe the sword behind them. But then, verse 3, but take some and tuck it away safely in your robe, the little remnant that God is going to work with. Now imagine, you know, this morning if we had, you know, somebody who we know with, you know, long hair and a beard, and they were in front of you this morning to shave their head bald, to shave off their beard, okay, and then they've got this big pile of hair, and they divide it into 3 sections, okay, and then one section, okay, they take it downtown, okay, you know, into the old market or wherever outside of Mutual of Omaha, and they burn it, okay. the next, okay, they walk around Omaha and they just scattering the hair, okay. And the next, they get a sword and they're chopping up with, you know. I mean, you would never forget that. You would never forget that. And what he's saying, and he gives the interpretation later on, is saying that one third of you are going to be consumed in the city, either by plague or by the siege, okay. Another third of you are going to be scattered, as Israel was scattered now out to Babylon, and one third of you are going to die by the sword. You know, it's a very, very dramatic way of speaking, and he doesn't say anything, okay? Because you remember he's often dumb, but you would never forget this kind of language, and so it's extremely dramatic. And so you've got these three prophetic acts: the model of Jerusalem, and him laying, bearing their iniquity; the symbolism of the siege rations or exile rations; the symbolism of shaving up his shaving his head and his beard, and then dividing it up. Now, what's happening here? I just want to point out something before we move on. If you look at what Jeremiah is doing, what Ezekiel is doing, and what Daniel will be doing, you can basically say that they're really doing four or five things. Firstly, they're acting as watchmen. They're acting as watchmen. And that's the metaphor. We had it last week. We have it in Jeremiah. We see it in Daniel as he opens his windows. And the job of a watchman, as I said last week, it's not like a mystic. It's becoming popular today, you know, to read the mystics, which I actually read myself, you know, or to enter into a contemplative prayer, which is absolutely right and biblical. But we mustn't stop there, because that is to do, okay, with our own life with God. But the prophet goes further than that, and he is to sound the trumpet, he is to sound the alarm, he is to rouse the nation, okay, he is to rouse the nation. And so this is there because there is impending danger. And so I often think, you know, that in this country we have early warning aircraft, and they're in the sky all the time. You know, there's never a time when those early warning aircraft are not flying across Alaska or wherever they might be in the world. You know, they'll come down and refuel, but before they come down, others will be up. You know, if that is true in the natural, how much more should it be in the spirit, that we act, okay, we act as an early warning system, okay, for the church and for our society. This is the role of the watchman. Then they acted as navigators, because you see, when Jerusalem fell, it was theologically inexplicable. If this is the city of the living God, okay, and he lives there, how can it ever be destroyed by the enemy? I mean, that's an impossibility. You see, theologically, for the Jews, Jerusalem could never be taken. That's why Jeremiah says, for 40 years, repent or this city will fall, and they don't believe him. How can it be? The ark is here. That's the throne of the living God. So what they act as is, when the unthinkable happens, they give interpretation to it. Okay, just as an example, at the end of the Second World War, okay, Shintoism collapsed in Japan. The emperor, you see, the emperor was divine. And now in the written history of Japan, in their written history, they had never suffered a national defeat in all their written history. Now, of course, you can't. If the emperor's divine, of course you can't suffer a victory. I mean, that's unthinkable. That's impossible. But they did. And Shintoism, you see, is no longer valid. And that's a little bit like what a Jew would feel like. And so the prophets stand in as navigators to explain what's going on. And that, again, is our role. Okay? We're to give interpretation. The prophets were saying there's something important here. They were acting as navigators for us to help us pray and help us intercede. They also act as ambassadors. And so as soon as Jeremiah gets down to Egypt, because you remember with the remnant, he didn't go to Babylon. They took him forcibly to Egypt. He starts prophesying to Pharaoh. And as soon as Daniel gets over there, he starts prophesying to Nebuchadnezzar and interpreting his dreams. And now we'll find in the middle of Ezekiel that he's prophesying to the surrounding nations. So they act as ambassadors. And then, of course, most importantly, they act as intercessors. And I say here that Jeremiah, we looked at that, Jeremiah 15:1, he is compared to the two great intercessors in the Old Testament, Moses and Samuel, because he has been in intercession for 40 years for his people. Ezekiel goes into captivity in 593, okay? He's heard Jeremiah, and he ministers at least until 571. So we know he's praying for 22 years for restoration, because he's seen it in his vision. Daniel goes into captivity, 593, and the last date we have in the book of Daniel is 538. And so he has been praying for 55 years. For 55 years. And what happens, I've said this before, is there was this little power called Persia and this mega power called Babylon. And for inexplicable reasons, Babylon goes into decline and Persia becomes the great dominant power. And the first year that Cyrus comes to the throne, he says, I think I should allow all the Jews to go home. Why should he do that? He shouldn't be in power, number one. Why would you do that? Why would you do that? You do that because Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel have been praying. You see, this is their role. This is their role. And I say that finally, they're envoys of hope. And the prophetic should always give us hope. Always give us hope. Often, you see, you remember that the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy, revelation. Okay, so prophecy sounds like Jesus. And so when you read Ezekiel, when you read Jeremiah, and you read these stern warnings, okay, God's not frowning, God's weeping. God's weeping. And we know that because when Jesus comes and they reject him, he weeps over the city. He weeps over the city. And so there's always this note of hope. And of course, who they are, the prophetic mantle has fallen on the church, and this is our task as we're scattered among the nations. Chapter 5, and we've got this prophetic act with him shaving his head, his hair and his beard, and that's interpreted in chapter 5. And then in chapter 6, you'll notice in verse 1, and the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, set your face towards the mountains of Israel and prophesy against them. Because on the mountains, you remember, they had set up their high places of pagan worship. It says in verse 4, so your altars, plural, they're only supposed to have one in Jerusalem, your altars will become desolate, and your incense altars will be smashed. So it's to prophesy against the pagan worship going on in Jerusalem. But notice in verse 9, the Lord says, then those of you who escape will remember me among the nations to which they have been carried captive, how I have been hurt by their adulterous hearts. And I always remember a good friend of mine who this day is in Christian ministry. He's not in Omaha. He has wonderful family, wonderful marriage, wonderful children serving the Lord. And there was a time when he had a very, very serious affair. Very, very serious affair. And I met him years after. And he said to me, still almost, you know, with tears in his eyes, he says, I never knew how much I hurt her. I never knew how much I hurt her. And God says, when this happens, you'll know how much you've hurt me. Because it was spiritual adultery, you see, because Israel was the Lord's bride, you know. And you see, God is being hurt here. So again, when you read the prophets, you know, don't see this scowling, angry God. This is a grieved lover in action here. And then in chapter 7, something very important comes here. Chapter 7 and verse 1, moreover, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, and you, son of man, thus says the Lord God to the land of Israel, an end is coming on the four corners of the land. Okay? Not just an end for 70 years. It's almost like the end of an era is now coming. This comes several times. Verse 5. Thus says the Lord God, a disaster, a unique disaster, behold, it is coming. And why it's unique is that now, the people of God, are going to be, from that day to this day, they are going to be in dispersion. In other words, it's not just a 70-year captivity, okay, because you know that when Cyrus comes to the throne in 538, okay, now the 10 tribes have disappeared, but Judah is still there. He says, you can go home, and only about 50,000 went back. And that meant when Jesus came, okay, there were twice as many Jews still in Babylon as there were in Israel. Large communities of Jews in Egypt, large communities of Jews in the Roman Empire. And so the unique thing was that the Jewish people from this point are going to be in dispersion until this day. Now, some did come back, okay? We've got Ezra, Nehemiah, etc., the Second Temple, okay? In 48, some did come back, but still the majority are in dispersion. So there's a kind of a decentralization that's happening now. You see, when we begin the Bible, okay, Genesis 1 to 11, this is what we've got. We've got God, we've got the earth, and we've got mankind. And we go through the flood, we go through the Tower of Babel, a long period of human history, we don't know how long. And it was getting worse and worse, and so this triangulation narrowed down. And from Genesis 12 through to Malachi, okay, we've got God, we've got the land, not the whole earth, and Israel, not mankind, okay? But God's intention in narrowing the focus is only so that when the time comes, okay, we can move out, okay, from what's been established and get out into the whole earth and into a humankind again. And two interesting things happen now. Is the first is that Israel goes into dispersion, and wherever they are, whether it's Babylon, okay, whether it's Egypt, okay, whether it is Syria, or whether it's Europe, whatever, what do the Jews start? All over the place. Synagogues, that's right. And so suddenly now the word of God is scattered throughout the Middle East, throughout what will be the Roman Empire, okay, throughout Northern Africa. And so when Paul goes with the gospel to a town, where's the first place he goes? That's right, because it's like they've done pre-evangelism. It's like Cornelius, you see, pre-evangelism had been done through the synagogue movement. And so although a disaster is coming, it will be a redemptive disaster, a redemptive disaster. And again, I showed you this before, and you see the kindness and the goodness of God working through the catastrophe of Israel, that they're going to need linguistic skills to reach the nations. But they only speak Hebrew, But after they've been over here, in this whole region, was a language called Aramaic, which became the language of the ordinary person. And so Jesus in the Gospels is speaking what language? That's right, Tabitha Kum, little girl arise, is Aramaic. Lama Lama Sabachthani, okay, on the cross, my God, Aramaic, etc. He spoke it, okay? And also, when Alexander marches in, okay, and comes down and takes territory, he brings in Greek. And we have Greek communities all over here. And then a little later, when the Romans come in, we have Latin coming in. And that's why even over the cross, what do they have to do when they say he's the king of the Jews? What do they have to do? Three languages, that's right, you see. And so a unique disaster is coming, but it will be redemptive. And that's so wonderful that everything God does, he seeks to redeem it for the salvation of mankind, which is wonderful. Now turn to chapter 8, and chapter 8 to chapter 11 is very, very interesting. And if you thought the shaving of the beard and the lying on the ground was interesting, now it really gets interesting. So chapter 8 and verse 2. Then I looked, and behold, the likeness as the appearance of a man. From his loins downward there was the appearance of fire, and from his loins upward the appearance of brightness, like the glowing of metal. And he stretched out the form of a hand and caught me by a lock of my head. So his hair's grown again now, okay? By a lock of my head. And the Spirit lifted me up between earth and heaven and brought me in the visions of God to Jerusalem. 550 air miles, okay? And so now, for the next few chapters, he's going to be in Jerusalem. Okay. Now, is he in Jerusalem in the spirit, or is he in Jerusalem in the body? Well, you'll need to decide. Okay. But one way or another, he is in Jerusalem. He is in Jerusalem. But here's the interesting thing. He comes to the temple. He comes to the temple, and he enters by the north. He enters by the north. Now, outside the perimeter gates, the north perimeter gate, he sees something. We'll come to that. He moves in, okay, and there are rooms. There are little rooms, priestly rooms, whether it was here or here, we're not quite sure, okay. But he digs into one of these rooms, and he sees something. So as he goes deeper in, he keeps seeing things. And then he moves to the northern gate, okay? This is the outer court. This is the northern gate to the inner court. There's something again. Then he moves right into the inner court. This is where the altar was. And he sees something again. And all these are occult activities happening in the temple. And so it is absolutely shocking, and we'll see it as we read through here. So chapter 8, he arrives in Jerusalem in the spirit. Okay, and verse 5, then he said to me, Son of man, raise your eyes now towards the north. So I raised my eyes towards the north, and behold, to the north of the altar gates was the idol of jealousy, or the lustful idol. So here he is, and here he sees this this idol, and I'll explain what it probably was in a minute. Then verse 7, he brought me then next to the entrance of the courts, when I looked, and behold, a hole in the wall. And he said to me, Son of man, now dig through the wall. So I dug through the wall, and behold, an entrance. And verse 10, so I entered and looked, and behold, every form of creeping things and beasts and detestable things with all the idols of the house of Israel were carved on the wall all around. And this is what they did in Egyptian temples. If you've seen pictures of Luxor or anywhere, you remember they're all carved into the wall, just like that. And notice, verse 11, and standing in front of them were the 70 elders of the house of Israel. These were the leaders of Israel, the 70 elders of the house of Israel. And so he moves to this, digs through the wall to one of these rooms, okay? Then he goes a little bit further to the north gates, to the courtyard. This is verse 14. Then he brought me to the entrance of the gate of the Lord's house, which was towards the north. This is now the inner gates. And behold, women were sitting there weeping for Tammuz. Tammuz was an Assyrian deity. And what happened is that in the dry season, he disappeared into the underworld. And so the women would kind of lament his disappearance, so he would come back and bring the rains. It was a fertility cult. And so that is that's right here. Then he moves right into the inner court here. Not the Holy of Holies here, that's here. This is where the altar is, the sacrificial altar. And there, verse 16, he brought me into the inner court of the Lord's house, and behold, at the entrance to the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 men with their backs to the temple, that would be to the holy place of the Lord, and their faces towards the east, and they were prostrating themselves towards the sun. They were worshipping the sun. And so what's going on here is it's like there's pollution at every level of the temple. It just gets worse, you know, as you process in, it just gets worse and worse. And so what you've got is, first of all, the northern gate at the perimeter, you've got this image of jealousy or the lustful image, which is probably Ashtara, the Canaanite deity. You move in a bit further, and you've got the room at the entrance to the courtyard covered with these unclean occult paintings, which is Egyptian occult activity. The 70 elders are there. Entrance to the inner north gate, the Assyrian deity, Tammuz. And then the inner courts, they're worshipping the rising sun. And it says there were 25, and it's probably the priests, you remember, were in 24 courses or kind of rosters led by the high priest, who would have been the 25th. And so now we've got corruption at every level of temple activity. Pagan deities from Cana, from Egypt, from Assyria, and of course sun worship was just kind of ubiquitous. It was everywhere. But it includes the elders, the 70 elders. It includes the priests, this 25 being probably the representative number. And it includes the women who would serve in the temple courts. And so it is just devastating. And I've mentioned before, it will say here in this chapter, in 8:17, it will use the words abominations or corruption and violence. The same word used in Genesis 6:11, and the angel seems to indicate that the corruption and violence that brought the old world under Noah to an end through the flood is now present again in Judah, Jerusalem, and even the temple. And God says, it's a cancer now. I've got to cut it out. And so this is a very, very sad and a very, very low point in the history of Israel. Okay. All the pagan deities have polluted the people of God on every level. Priests, elders, serving women, etc. He's still in Jerusalem now. Okay. 9, verse 1. Then he cried out in my hearing with a loud voice. This is this angelic guide. Draw near, O executioners of the city, each with his destroying weapon in his hand. And behold, 6 men came from the direction of the upper gate, which faces north, each with his... What translation do you have there? With his... Deadly weapon, club, axe, shattering weapon in his hand. And among them was a certain man clothed in linen with a writing case and his loins, and they went in and stood beside the altar, the bronze altar. And verse 4, and the Lord said to him, this is the man with the writing case, go through the midst of the city, even through the midst of Jerusalem, and put a mark, which is a tav, last letter of the Hebrew alphabet, that's the word here. Put a tav, okay, on the forehead, go through the city after him, and strike, do not let your eye have pity, and do not spare. And verse 7, he said to them, this is the six destroying angels, defile the temple and fill the courts with the slain. Okay, except those who had been marked with the tav on their foreheads. And verse 8, and it came about as they were striking, and I alone was left. So these corpses are falling all around him, whether in the spirit, in vision, or whatever. And I fell on my face, and I cried out, saying, Lord God, are you going to destroy the whole remnant? Verse 9, then he said to me, the iniquity of the house of Israel and Judah is very great, and the land, again, is filled with violence, and the city is full of perversion. And I mentioned to you last week that when the exiles come over here, it's very interesting, and I've got to draw the Euphrates River now, okay? The Tigris and the Euphrates kind of run like this. And then there was this irrigation canal called the River Chebar, and Ezekiel's community was living somewhere there, okay? And you remember, it was at a little place called Tel Abib, Tel Abib. And you remember we talked about what tells were. And they said that Tel Abib had not been inhabited since the flood. That was the legend. And now God says twice in 8:17 and 9:9 that the land is full of violence and full of pollution, same as Genesis 6:11. So they're going to have to go through the flood of God's wrath. But you remember there's a little remnant hidden in the garment. Remember? Some was burnt, some was chopped with the sword, some scattered to the wind. But there's a remnant. And it's like God says that this little remnant, okay, in Tel Abib, they're going to repopulate the earth, as it were, metaphorically. Now, what's interesting here in chapter 9, the destroying angels, is that the tav, the letter tav, anybody know how it's written? The letter tav? It's a cross. It's a cross. Very wonderful. Very wonderful. So they're marked with the sign of the cross. The letter tav is a cross. He says, if they're marked with the cross, you can't touch them. You can't touch them. All the rest will die. So it's wonderfully, wonderfully speaking into our day. But for the rest, normally you had a rite of sanctuary in the temple. You couldn't be slain in the temple. But now they're going to be slain in the temple, and the temple now will become ritually unclean, ritually unclean. And Ezekiel is going to cry out, he's going to intercede, but it's really too late. It's too late now. But God is going to be redemptive, as I say, but it's the end of a very sad thing. And I want you to notice something now that's very important. We're still in Jerusalem in the Spirit, and it flows on from here to chapter 10 and verse 1. And you'll notice in chapter 10 he sees again the vision of the glory of God, God's great war chariot that he saw in chapter 1 again. He sees that, and that's described again for us in chapter 10. So we won't go through it piece by piece, because we've done that when we looked at chapter 1. But chapter 10 and verse 1, and he spoke to the man clothed in linen and said, enter between the whirling wheels under the cherubim, the whirling wheels of God's great war chariots, and fill your hands with coals of fire that were between the cherubim, and scatter them over the city, almost like kind of incendiary bombs, and the city is now set on fire. Now the interesting thing is when this was done, okay, when the people were slain, the angels enter Jerusalem and the temple in chapter six, destroying angels, and then they take the hot coals and they scatter them over the city. Of course, that was done by who? Yeah, that in the spirit is being done, that's right, by the destroying angels. But actually, it was the Babylonians that did it. And so what you've got here is something very important and very interesting that you find all the way through the scriptures. And that is that here, okay, actually the people who are going to physically do it is the Babylonian army. But standing behind them are destroying angels, okay? And so you move on to Cyrus, okay? But standing behind Cyrus, Daniel has to battle, you remember, with the prince of Persia. Okay, we go to Egypt and we've got Pharaoh being hard-hearted, but behind him is standing the principalities and powers of the pharaonic gods. Come to the New Testament, and yes, you've got Pilate and Herod and Caiaphas, but of course standing behind them is the principality of principalities, Satan himself. And so why this is important is that we see this kind of apocalyptic picture of the angels moving through the city and destroying, slaying people, and then burning the city. But that was physically done, by the Babylonians. So what we need to understand is behind the three-dimensional, okay, is the invisible, okay, supernatural, demonic, principalities and powers. Now where this gets very interesting, you might want to turn just for a minute to Romans 13, because you all know Ephesians 6, where Paul says, we wrestle not with flesh and blood, you remember, but with principalities and powers. Remember that? Don't wrestle with flesh and blood, but with... But principalities and powers are used in two ways in the Bible. And of course, all a principality is, in fact, you still have some principalities in Europe. This is a prince over a polity, okay? I think Liechtenstein is still a principality, if I remember. And so Romans 13, Paul says, is speaking of human government, let every person being subject to the governing powers. Same word. But these are three-dimensional. This is Caesar, etc. Verse 2, for he who resists the power has opposed the ordinances of God. He's talking about government. And then verse 3, for principalities are not a cause of fear, okay, for good behavior, but for evil. And so he's talking about normal structures. And at this time, they were good. Basically, they were holding back anarchy in the empire. But what we have to understand in our day is whether it's a Hitler or a Stalin or abortion or whatever, okay, that's happening right where we are on the tangible, touchable, three-dimensional realm, behind it stand principalities and powers. Do you see what I mean? And so we've got this amazing picture that he's seeing in the spirit, okay? And you'll find that in the book of Revelation, you see. Much of what's happening in the book of Revelation, okay, is a portrayal of what's happening in the realm of spiritual warfare. And then it impacts the earth. You with me? Okay, with me? That's important to see as we go through this material. So the destroying angels go through the city, but they mark with the tav, with the cross, the righteous, who can't be touched. And so we have, I think, a portrayal of principalities and powers that will actually be fleshed out in the Babylonians. And then chapter 11, and again, This is very interesting, and there are some parts of the prophets that you have to smile and say, well, we don't understand everything, because chapter 11 and verse 1, it says, moreover, the Spirit of the Lord lifted me up and brought me to the east gate of the Lord's house. Remember, in the Spirit he is still in Jerusalem, which faced eastward, and behold, there were 25 men probably royal counselors, at the entrance of the gates. Among them I saw Jazaniah, the son of Azur, and Pelatiah, the son of Benaniah. And they were probably, as you read through the chapter, they're realizing that the Babylonians are on the way. They're probably thinking about an alliance with Egypt for protection. That's probably why they're taking counsel together. And verse 5, thus the Spirit of the Lord fell upon me, and he starts to prophesy. And you can read it there, verse 10. And he says to them, you'll fall by the sword. I shall judge you to the borders of Israel, so you'll know that I am the Lord. In verse 13, and it came about as I prophesied that Pelatiah, the son of Benaniah, fell down dead. And so we don't know what's happening here, because he is prophesying, and as he prophesies, this man falls down dead. So is he in the spirit in Jerusalem, or has the Lord airlifted him to Jerusalem? We don't know. We don't know. But he does prophesy, and as he prophesies, probably Pelatiah was the ringleader of this, not going into repentance, but going into back into Egypt and into the flesh. But there's one in this, before we close this section, there's one very, very interesting and wonderful thing that we will see. Okay, wonderful thing. Okay, I'll show you this in these chapters. While Ezekiel is in Jerusalem, and remember now, the temple is defiled by occult practices and dead bodies now, and the Lord is going to exit. And in 9:3, and I'll show you this in the text, he moves from the Holy of Holies out to the threshold. Okay? Then in 10:19, he moves from the threshold to the east gates. And then in 11:23, he moves out of the temple to the Mount of Olives, where the glory of the Lord then ascends. Now let me just show it to you. Back to 9:3, and you can mark it in your Bible. Okay, he's still in Jerusalem in the spirit, and this is what he sees. 9:3, the glory of the God of Israel went up from the cherub, okay, over the mercy seats on which it had been, out to the threshold of the temple. So moves from the Holy of Holies to the threshold. Then to 10:19, then the glory of the Lord departed from the threshold of the temple and stood over the cherubim. Verse 19, and when the cherubim departed, they lifted their wings and rose up from the earth in my sight with the wheels beside them, and they stood still at the entrance of the east gates of the Lord's house. And so now the Lord has moved. You see, he's departing from the temple, moves to the east gates, and then over to chapter 11, and the glory of the Lord, this is verse 23, went up from the midst of the city and stood over the mountain which is east of the city. That's the Mount of Olives. Okay, so the glory of the Lord moves to the Mount of Olives. And then the Spirit lifted me up and brought me in a vision by the Spirit of God back to the exiles. And so the presence of the Lord now departs from the city, from the Mount of Olives. But Ezekiel, remember, as is over here, okay, as is over here, the glory of the Lord appears to him. Remember. So it's now like the glory of the Lord has shifted from the temple out to the Gentiles. Now why this is so interesting is, this is what is so beautiful about this picture. Okay, we've discussed this, the destroying angels, etc., the death of Pelatiah. I'll come back to the synagogues in a moment. Okay, I'll come back to this departure of the Lord. Okay, after this metaphorical ascension from the Mount of Olives, okay, what was locked in to the holy place, the glory, the Shekinah, the cherubs, the throne, becomes available to the Gentiles. And so Ezekiel, by the river Chebar, sees the glory of God. Okay, what was locked in now comes out. What was localized now becomes globalized. Now, why this is so intriguing, and important, okay, is Jesus will be driven out of the temple, he'll be driven out of Jerusalem, he'll be driven out to Golgotha, and then he will ascend. Do you remember from where he ascends? That's right, from the Mount of Olives. Because in Ezekiel, you see, when the glory of God was rejected from the temple, it ascended, okay, Ezekiel 11, from the Mount of Olives. And so when Jesus, okay, is driven out of the temple because of the pollution, because of what was going on, out of Jerusalem, rejected, out to the cross, okay, comes back in resurrection, and he has to ascend, you see, because in him dwells the glory of God. He ascends from the Mount of Olives. But then 10 days later, all that was lost, okay, you remember Pentecost, it says, gathered in Jerusalem were those from every nation under heaven. And suddenly the glory has come back, okay, but now it's available to every nation under heaven. The same picture as is built in Ezekiel, where now the glory of God, as it were, departs, and you're going to find it over in Babylon among the exiles, among the nations. Now, the Lord's presence will return in chapter 43. The glory of the Lord comes back to the temple. You remember that? It comes back from the east, same way as it departed. And so in chapter 53, what happened is the glory of the Lord comes back again. Chapter 43. Now the question is, okay, when? The question is, when? You can turn to 43 just to see that for a moment. Ezekiel gets better and better as you go along. Okay? And so in 43, it will say, then he led me to the east gate. Okay, this is the new Jerusalem. He led me to the gate facing towards the east. And behold, the Shekinah, the glory of the God of Israel, was coming from the way of the east. And his voice was like the sound of many waters. And the earth shone with his glory. Isn't that beautiful? Now what I want to know, when is that going to happen? When is that going to happen? Well, there are a number of alternatives, okay? Now, we need to know when it didn't happen, first of all, okay? We need to know when it didn't happen, okay? Because, of course, as Moses says, you see, it's the presence of God, it's the glory of God, Moses says, Exodus 33, that distinguishes us from all the other people on the face of the earth. It's not that we carry Bibles, okay? Muslims carry holy books. It's not that we go into religious buildings. Hindus go into religious buildings, okay? What distinguishes us, okay, is that the Shekinah should be in our midst, the presence of the Lord. Now, it didn't come back, okay? You remember I said Cyrus comes to the throne over here. This is Persia, 538 BC. Some of them go back, okay? But the old men weep when they build the temple, okay? And they weep because there is no ark, there is no Shekinah, and there's no fire from heaven, okay? In the tabernacle, you had the ark, you had the Shekinah, and you had fire from heaven. In the temple, you had the ark, you had the Shekinah, and you had fire from heaven. Well, is it really a temple? If you don't have those things, well, yes and no kind of thing. In 164, okay, the Maccabees cleanse the temple, and this is Hanukkah, but no ark, no Shekinah, and no fire from heaven. Okay, so Herod steps on the scene, who was rather a rascal, kind of a converted Edomite, who really didn't have any right to reign at all, and in 19 BC he starts reconstructing the second temple. not a third temple, it's a reconstruction. And the reconstruction went on for 83 years. Okay? It's amazing, amazing. It just went on. The amusing thing is after they'd finished in 64 AD, the Romans came in a few years later and knocked it all down. So you see, there's not what God is after anymore. Okay? He's had that with Solomon. He's after something else. So when does the glory come back? Well, there's more than one answer. There's more than one answer. And you remember, the Word becomes flesh and tabernacled or tented among us. And we beheld His. So we know that the Shekinah came back in Jesus. In fact, it's interesting, the little word here, skena, is the word for tent or tabernacle. But you remember in Hebrew, okay, there are no vowels. Skena, if you just put in other vowels, okay, tents, is Shekinah. You can almost see it there. You see, if you add, it would be Shekinah. You with me? Okay, same thing in Hebrew, just in consonants. So it's like in the Gospel of John, it's being said in two ways. So the Word became flesh and tented, tabernacled, but this is the Skena, the Shekinah, and we beheld His glory, okay? And that's very wonderful. And then when the Holy Spirit comes upon Mary, it says the power of the Most High will overshadow you. You remember Mary seeing the angel? And this word is the same in Exodus, when the glory cloud overshadowed and the glory of the Lord filled the temple, filled the tabernacle. And so Jesus comes, okay, to His tabernacle in the womb of Mary, okay, because the Shekinah is coming back. And then more intriguingly, Jesus says, remember, where two or three are gathered, what does He say? There am I in the midst. He was quoting a rabbinic saying, you see, that now they don't have a Shekinah, okay, and they're in exile all over the place. And the rabbis had a statement that said, where two or three are gathered, there the Shekinah is in the midst, okay, because they knew, you see, when the glory of God left the temple, it reappeared, you see what I mean, it was among the exiles. And so they had this little statement, where two or three are gathered, there the Shekinah is in the midst. And so Jesus takes that up, and He says, where two or three are gathered, there am I. Because, of course, He is the Shekinah. And so we know in the first Advent, okay, the glory of God came back to the temple. Okay? But we're not finished yet. We're not finished yet. There's more to come. There's more to come. And we'll see that when we get to the end of Ezekiel and see what's happening when it happened in Jesus, okay, but God's not done. And of course at the end of Revelation, now we've got, behold, the tabernacle, okay, of God is with man, okay, and they'll have no need of the sun or the moon because the Shekinah is so bright.